Tim. All right, on Wednesday night, our missional community, which is a small group that meets during the week to study the Bible, to hang out and to try and follow Christ together. We went to the Avalon RSL Club to watch The Origin, and the idea was we want to be out and about a bit as a group, be out in the community, getting to know people and seeing what God does. So as we're at the RSL, a bunch of us, we had two tables, probably about, I don't know, maybe 8 to 10 of us were there. In the second half, no, I think it was still the first half, this guy came over and sat next to me, and he was very drunk, probably about 10 to 12 beers into the night, I think he was, but he could still speak pretty legibly, and I thought he knew Cam. Cam was sitting on the other side of me, and I thought he knew him, and I thought he knew who we were, because he was using Jesus' name in vain a lot, like using it as a swear word, like again and again and again, like you see him right next to me. So I thought he knew who I was, that I was a minister, and I'm just doing it to insult me as a joke. So it turns out he had no idea who we were at all. And then he's like, I said to him, what do you do? And he's like, I'm a concreter. And he's like, man, I'd have to pour a lot of concrete to earn as much money as those Origin guys, and they can't even catch the ball. What's going on, you know? And then he said to me, what do you do? I said, I'm a minister. He's like, what? You're a minister? And then we had a full-on 45-minute conversation, and he hardly watched the rest of the Origin game at all. But it wasn't much of a game anyway, apparently. I didn't watch the rest of it. And so we had a long chat, and his friend Chris came over as well. And one of the things that Mick was saying was that he loves the Ten Commandments, actually. So he's got a church background, Catholic upbringing, went to different Catholic schools, and actually went to Protestant schools as well on rugby scholarships, but then ended up in prison somewhere along the way for 2 years. And but anyway, he's 35 years old, and he's a concreter, 3 kids. But he doesn't believe in God. He's an atheist. He thinks it's all made up and BS. That was what he said to me. But he does like the Ten Commandments. He thinks the Ten Commandments are great. You know, morality is great. He said, you know, to summarize the Ten Commandments, it's basically don't be a beep. That was his summary of the Ten Commandments. Pretty good summary. And so it got me thinking, because how can you actually have morality without God? How can you have good and evil without God? Now, morals, the word morals, are standards of behavior and principles of right and wrong. That's what the word morals means, standards of behavior, principles of right and wrong. So when we're talking about morality, we're talking about what's right and wrong, what we believe about what's right and wrong. Everybody has a belief about what's right and wrong, no matter if they're an atheist, a Buddhist, a Christian, a Muslim. Every single person on this earth has a set of beliefs about what's right and wrong. But you can't have any basis for those beliefs if you don't believe in some sort of God. There's no reason to believe in any good or any evil if there is no God. Because how can there be good and evil if the world is just material world and a cold, empty universe? There can be no good, there can be no evil, there can be no morality that's based on anything if there is no God. And it's funny, because I was sort of reflecting on this conversation I had with Mick, the concreter. He had said that he loves the Ten Commandments, but he'd been breaking the third commandment the whole night, which is, do not take the Lord's name in vain. Which is interestingly, and he was using lots of dirty language, which is not really in the Ten Commandments, but it's in the rest of the Bible, talks about not using dirty language and etc. And he was drunk, and the Bible talks about do not get drunk, because that leads to debauchery. So he was picking and choosing some of the morals from the Bible and not the others. But where do morals come from? Can we really have any morality without God? Pastor Tim Keller, my favourite pastor, if you, in case you didn't realise, people still have strong moral convictions, he said, but unlike people in other times and places, they don't have any visible basis for why they find some things to be evil and other things to be good. It's almost like their moral intuitions are free-floating in midair, far off the ground. So that's him looking at his culture in New York City and saying that everyone's still got moral convictions. They believe in what's right and wrong in their own way, but it's like they're free-floating off the ground. They have no visible basis for their beliefs. They've ditched God, but they've kept morality. But you can't do that. Because if you believe something is wrong or right, then that belief, that means that you're saying there's some kind of objective moral standard in the universe by which you are judging people, and there can be no such thing without God of some kind. And in this sermon, I want to explore an aspect of this. I want to show how Christianity provides a basis for morality, what's right and wrong. Okay, not there yet. Okay, so most people think that if you behave in a morally good way, whatever you think that means, that will qualify you to be a good person. And if you behave in a morally bad way, that will qualify you to be a bad person. But as we've already seen in this letter to the Colossians, the Christian logic is really different to that. The Christian logic is behave in a morally good way because by the grace of God, you have already been made into a good person by grace. You are already a good person, not because you deserved it, because God made you into one. He's changed you. So therefore, behave like that. The Christian logic is behave according to what you are now. Christian morality comes out of Christian identity. Let me try to illustrate this. Just imagine there's a man who's very poor. It's England 200 years ago, before there was much social welfare. He's got a wife and a few kids, but they're really poor. There's never enough food. The kids are always hungry. They live in a tent in the park in London. It's freezing in winter. They're always getting sick. Some of the kids have died already of pneumonia. The kids, if they are going to school, are doing really bad in school because they're so hungry. They have no shelter at home. Their clothes are in tatters. They're not washed. They are all depressed and hopeless. Like that photo, kind of, almost all of them, not all of them. What good could happen to this family? Well, imagine that a guy with a top hat, a really rich guy, or rich-looking guy, comes to this family. And he finds the man and he says, "Are you Mr. Frederick Anderson, son of Robert Anderson?" And he says, and the guy, the poor man, says, "Yeah, I'm Fred. What do you want with me? Am I in trouble?" But the man with the top hat says, "I'm a lawyer. And I'm acting on behalf of the estate of Bill Anderson, your father's brother. He has just died, and he was ridiculously rich, and you are his only surviving relative, and it's all going to come to you. His mansion in London, all the furniture in the house, his holiday houses, his farms, and his bank accounts with many, many lifetimes worth of money in them. This is all yours now." Fred would be transformed, wouldn't he? He would be able to put a roof over his family, put food on the table, keep them warm, pay the best doctors to treat them when they're sick, send them to the best schools, take them on fun holidays. But just imagine, despite this newfound wealth, Fred decided that he's going to stay in the park and continue to starve and see his kids keep getting sick and dying from pneumonia. If Fred did that, he would not be acting in line with his new reality. He would be living in line with his old reality, like it was before. And that would be crazy. It would be insane for Fred to do that. The point of the illustration is that Christians have a new reality, a new identity. By grace, they didn't deserve it. We didn't deserve it. And it's better than what we had before, a lot better. And the message for Christians is act who you are now. Don't go on living in the park freezing in winter because you've been radically transformed. Behave in line with who you've been made to be. And this logic continues in our passage today. So, look with me at Colossians 3, 5 to 9 in front of you there. "Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived, but now you must also rid yourselves of all such things as these, anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Do not lie to each other. I'll just pause there. So we already talked about verse 5 last week, and we talked about pornography. And the summary of that verse is, there are behaviours that we may have used to participate in, but have no place now if you are a Christian. And kill those behaviours. If ever they raise their ugly head in your life, kill it, shoot it, destroy it, don't let it come back. And then in verse 6 here, Paul mentions that because of these things, these corrupt behaviours that humanity is engaged in, the wrath of God is coming. Wrath. Actually, the Americans say wrath, which makes a lot more sense, because there is an A in that word, but we say wrath, I don't know why. Don't ask me why. The word simply means anger. Exactly what it means, just anger. Now, it might surprise you that God is angry. But think about this. If God were truly loving, which we believe he is, then he would also be angry at evil. If he was indifferent to evil, if he didn't care about evil, if it didn't bother him, then he wouldn't really be loving. So a loving God has to have anger against evil to be loving. Can you imagine if God was not angry at all the kids, about all the kids that have been abused? Of course God is angry towards evil. He's going to punish evil because he's loving and righteous. His anger, his wrath, is going to come upon all the wickedness of humanity. And that is good. But it puts us all on notice. He's restraining his anger. He's giving us all a chance to turn away from our evil. And the way we can escape the wrath of God is if we allow Jesus to take the anger for us, to absorb it for us on the cross. And we already sung about that. Did you notice that? I'm just going to do this. There. Till on that cross as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied. So God's anger was extinguished. His anger towards us was extinguished on the cross. Jesus took the brunt of the anger in himself for us. That's one of the things that happened. It's pretty remarkable. Okay, fast forward again. All right. Now, in verse 8, we're told that we must rid ourselves of such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from our lips, and not lie to each other. It's interesting because God has righteous anger against evil, but often our anger that we have in life is a bit tainted. So I think there's times and a place for righteous anger, the point is we shouldn't let anger fester and stew away in us because it's toxic for us. If you're always angry, it's toxic. You may have experienced that. It will destroy you, it will destroy your relationships around you. So we need to rid ourselves of those. And a bunch of forms of speech are listed here, like malice, slander, filthy language, lying. These are all out of step with Jesus Christ, because they are all anti-love. They are anti-peace. They destroy relationships. But let's keep moving in that passage. Okay, to verse 9 to 11. So second part of verse 9. Since you've taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Here there is no Gentile or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. So this is another way of what we've been already talking about the Christian has a new reality and we should live according to our new reality. It's a bit like taking off an old self, an old person, putting on a new self, a new person, a new life, like a change of clothes. But notice it's in the past tense. You have taken off your old self. That's already happened. You have put on the new self. That's already happened. So we have a new reality. But there's something here which is present tense as well, something that's still happening. In verse 10, and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. So the new self, which the Christian has already put on, is still being renewed. It's being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. But what does that mean? If you're familiar with the Bible, you will know that the image of God is a really important theme. Way back in the first chapter, it said, then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Humanity, we, male and female, are all created in God's image, in his likeness. This means we all reflect God in some way. It's pretty special. We all resemble God in some way. Nothing else in all creation, not the birds, not the animals, not the plants, not the planets, not the stars, nothing else is created in the image of God. Only men and women, humanity, are created in the image of God. Humans are special. Isn't it funny? Not funny, a bit sad. With the little boy that fell into the gorilla enclosure in Cincinnati Zoo this week. A four-year-old boy slipped through, and there was a huge gorilla dragging him around, and, you know, it was very scary. So the zookeepers had to shoot the gorilla because they thought he would kill the boy. And then all these animal activists were so angry. You can't shoot the gorilla, they said. And they're almost implying that they didn't mind if the little boy was killed because the gorilla was more special for them. But that's not the way it is. Humans are special. Humans are sacred in a way that animals are not. Of course, it's terrible. It's a tragedy that the animal had to die. But the boy was more important than the animal, even though the animal was a special animal. So, humans reflect or resemble God. And this means several things, including we rule over creation on God's behalf. So we reflect God's rule. We are personal like God is. That is, we are relational. We're not just individual by ourselves or alone. We love. We have relationships like God does. We are moral like God is. That is, we can be good or evil. Of course, God is always good. He never does evil. But we have the choice. We know what good and evil is. A dog or a cat doesn't really know. An ant doesn't know what's good or evil. Being in the image of God, reflecting God, being like God in some way, means we are responsible to live in a good and moral way, a way that's characterized by love, like God does. No animal or plant or planet is obligated to live in a moral way, in a loving way. In fact, this understanding of humanity created in the image of God is a major part of the basis of Christian morality. And it explains why some things are good and why some things are wicked. Back in Genesis chapter 9, it said, whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind. That is, one reason why we shouldn't murder somebody is because they are in the image of God. They are sacred. Do not kill something that is in the image of God. That's an affront against God himself because they are in his image. Human life is sacred. The fact that we are created in the image of God means, as I've been saying, that we are morally responsible. And that is, we are responsible to live by the standard of God because we're in his image. We're not in the image of something else. We're in God's image. And to be truly and fully human is to live in tune with our Creator. But even though humans were created in the image of God, as you know, that image has been marred, broken. It's still there, but it's cracked. We fail to reflect God adequately. But there's one human being who didn't. And that, of course, is Jesus. In Colossians 1:15, we saw that the Son, that's Jesus, is the image of the invisible God. Jesus is the true image of God. He's not the marred image. He's not the tainted image. He's the true image. So if you want to know what it means to be truly, properly human, look at Jesus Christ. For the Christian, part of our ongoing transformation in life is to be restored into the image of God again, more and more. The taking away that brokenness and that taintedness of that image, restoring it, polishing it. That's why in Colossians 3 verse 10, it talks about being renewed in knowledge in the image of its Creator. Renewed. So being renewed in knowledge, because knowledge is an integral part of being in the image of God. If we don't know God, how can we reflect Him well? So knowledge is key. And this is not the only place the Bible talks about restoring that image of God. In 2 Corinthians 3:18 it says, "We are being transformed into Jesus' image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit." So we are being transformed into Jesus' image. That's the destination for the Christian, created in the image of God. That image has been marred and tainted for all of humanity. It's still there, but it's been tainted. But the Christian journey is to be restored into the image of Christ, who is the true image of God. We know where we're going. We know where the destination is. And part of the way we image God or reflect God is in our behavior, in our morality, in our life. Loving others like He does. So I've just got three quick points to end. Very quick. Because humanity has been created in the image of God, this means we treat every human being with dignity and respect. Doesn't matter what gender they are, male or female, doesn't matter what ethnicity they are, doesn't matter how rich or poor they are, we treat every human being with respect because they're created in the image of God. And that's what verse 11 is about. It doesn't matter if male or female, doesn't matter if slave or free, doesn't matter their social economic status, doesn't matter if they're Jew or Gentile, barbarian or Scythian. And Scythians were the most hated ethnic group at the time, or the most despised. They were like uncouth savages. Doesn't matter what ethnic group or cultural group we come from, every human being is created in the image of God and therefore should be treated with respect and dignity. So when you're at school, there's no reason to pick on some other kid. That kid is created in the image of God. Or in the workplace or wherever you are in life, do we treat people with respect? Second application point is that if you're not a believer in Jesus, the message from this sermon is to consider the basis for your morality. How do you decide what's right and wrong? What's your moral standard? What's your basis for it? And I put it to you that if you believe anything is wrong or anything is right, then you have to believe in God. That's the logical conclusion. You cannot believe in right and wrong in an objective sense unless you believe in some sort of higher power. Thirdly, the last point for the Christian, live into your new identity. You have been changed by grace. You have put off an old self. You have died to an old life. You have put on a new self. You've been raised to a new life. So live in tune with that. Put to death what belongs to the old life and focus on what belongs to the new life. Let me pray. Father, I thank you for your word. Thank you for the privilege it is to be created in in your image. That's just incredible. I pray that we would know more and more what that means and how to reflect you as we live our lives. Help us to bring you honor in the way we live our lives. And help us to treat others with dignity and respect. And I pray that we would continue to live in tune with our new reality that you've given us, and that we wouldn't get back to the old way, but we'd be just really excited about the new life that you've given us. And we want to thank you for that and praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.